crossover Sports Illustrated's NBA show, breaking down the latest news, rumors, and everything in between. Here's your host, Chris Mannix, Rohan Nadkami, and Chris Herring.
And we are back. Crossover NBA podcast. I'm Chris Mannix. We are recording this on a Friday afternoon where we have at least one NBA conference finalist already set. Joined from South Florida by Rohan Nadkarni and from New York, Chris Herring, who is eagerly awaiting to see the outcome of his Knicks in this series against the Miami Heat. Fellas, we're going to get to Heat versus Knicks a little bit later on, but I want to start with what we saw in Philadelphia last night, which was both a embarrassing collapse by the 76ers and a virtuoso 4.5 minute performance by Jason Tatum in the final half of that fourth quarter. Tatum scored 16 points. The Celtics pull off a double-digit win, and we have a Game 7 on Sunday in Boston. So, Herring, I'll start with you. Are you more impressed by what Tatum did down the stretch or disappointed by what you saw from Philadelphia?
That's a really great question. I think on some level, I'm not shocked that Tatum did that. It was still really wild to watch it play out. But there have been so many moments, and at this point, and I know Rohan just wrote this story about the fact that at this point you have no choice but to take Denver seriously. That was a moment where Philly could have stepped on Boston's throat and basically said, we're here looking at the other side of it. We've got an 8 seed and a 5 seed on the other side of the bracket. This is ours to take. And Embiid being an MVP, you got a couple 40-point games from Harden in this series. Maxey has been fantastic. This was an opportunity. This was on their home floor. They're not going to have anybody to blame but themselves if they don't get this done in 7. They took game 1 without Embiid. They had a golden opportunity there. I mean, you hold Jason Tatum to 1 of 14 or whatever it was to start a game. I don't care if he makes 4 threes at the end of it or whatever it was. Tatum, we know he's capable, and we know if he makes one that he's going to feel like he can make them all. But that doesn't excuse Philly's offense just falling off a cliff at the end of the game. I thought that they could have won that game despite Tatum regaining a rhythm at the end of it. Whereas the flip side of it was Boston was not going to win without Tatum doing anything. And that became clear, but that doesn't mean Philly couldn't have won the game. And so it's disappointing from that standpoint. And it's one of those tough things where you don't get to wallow over that. I wrote in my book about the 90s Knicks that John Starks had insomnia, essentially developed insomnia after having his shot blocked at the end of a game 6 that, you know, could have won the title for them. And it stayed with them for days, and it kind of bled into the next game. You can't afford that if you're Philly, because you've shown now that you're toe-to-toe with this team. You're capable of beating this team. You should have beaten this team. But I do say that, you know, I would say that the disappointment should be heavier from that standpoint than the impressed feeling that I had from Tatum, because we knew he was capable of that.
Yeah, Rowan, I don't want to take anything away from Jason Tatum. I want to get to him in a minute and what Boston did in that game. But this was such a moment for Philadelphia. They haven't been to a conference final since 2001. Not an NBA finals, not a championship. They haven't been to a conference finals since 2001. And they survived an early storm from Boston. They turned a 7-point halftime deficit into a 2-point lead going into the fourth quarter. Jason Tatum was just a mess. You go even like 8 minutes or at the 8-minute mark of that fourth quarter, I think I tweeted this out, like Tatum was just standing around, like just didn't look like he was engaged in this game at all. And then the final like 5 minutes, did they even score a bucket in that final 5 minutes? I mean, Joel Embiid, you know, made a note of this after the game. He didn't even touch the ball. Like, he's got to have the ball in his hands in those situations. I thought this was an epic fail by Philadelphia not to win this game 6.
Okay, I've been, from the moment that game ended, I've been waiting to get on this podcast because I have so much to say. All day yesterday, preparing all my tweets, making fun of the city of Boston for their impending collapse in this game, getting ready to come on this podcast, talk mad shit to Mannix, couldn't wait, excited all day. Philly's going into the fourth quarter with a lead. Guys, this was a pathetic performance by the Sixers. Epic failure is just scratching the surface. For the last 2 years, Joel Embiid complaining about, why am I not the MVP? I'm the MVP. He gets a beautiful feature written about him by Chris Mannix in Sports Illustrated. I want to be the MVP. He gets the award. In the last 6 minutes of the game, 0 for 2, no points, no rebounds, no assists. Are you kidding me? The fact that they couldn't get him the ball, could you imagine Giannis going 6 minutes in a fourth quarter of a closeout game without getting the ball? You see what Nikola Jokic has been doing in the second round? He touches the ball every single possession for the Nuggets. I thought it was inexcusable. I thought it was embarrassing. The fact that James Harden is firing these rocket passes to the corner with 15 seconds on the shot clock and says, D'Anthony Melton, you shoot. PJ Tucker, you shoot. They played that fourth quarter like they had a 10-point lead, and they kept going for these home run shots. I thought it was pathetic. I thought their offensive process was terrible. They didn't get anything going at the rim for seemingly the last 6 minutes of the game. I thought Tyrese Maxey was the only player who seemingly had guts for Philly last night. Tobias Harris, 2 points in 42 minutes? He's lucky Jason Tatum was as bad as he was for 3.5 quarters, because we'd be killing Tobias Harris way more today for that performance. 1 of 7, 2 points in 42 minutes. You could throw Mannix out there, his hair gel dripping into his eyes. I bet he could come up with one bucket in 42 minutes. I was just blown away by how bad Philly was in the fourth quarter of this game. You go into the fourth quarter with a lead at home. What Chris said, with the chance to step on Boston's throat, knock out what was the title favorite, you know, headed into this round at the very least. To me, like, as much as we praise James Harden and Joel Embiid for some of the performances they put up earlier in this series, this was the biggest stage for them, and I thought they were both awful down the stretch. Harden, you look at Harden and Tatum's final stat lines. I mean, it's not like Harden played that much better. He was a little bit more efficient. You know, his scoring just wasn't as backloaded. I was in shock watching the fourth quarter, watching Philly just completely just trip over themselves offensively. I thought it was pathetic, frankly. I really did.
I don't know how I got dragged in that situation, but whatever. I do agree with you. It was a complete meltdown by Philly. They didn't react well at all to Boston's adjustment to go two bigs. That was a big factor in this game. Robert Williams was plus 18 overall. Mm-hmm. And you could see early on the impact that he had. Just giving James Harden and Tyrese Maxey and, you know, something to think about when they went to the rim. Giving, you know, Joel Embiid something to think about as he was coming off and defending screens. Because, you know, when you're defending a Rob Williams screen, you got to be wary of that lob. Like, that's just, that's what he does offensively. And I thought that was a good adjustment by Joe Mazzulla and not one that the Sixers adjusted to all that well. And look, we've got to give credit to the Celtics, you know, the role players on that team. Marcus Smart was great. You know, he had some moments where he had, Marcus Smart had some moments there where he had some bad turnovers, tried to thread the needle a couple of too many times. But overall, he was terrific offensively, defensively, the whole package. Jaylen Brown, before he got into foul trouble, he made some plays for them. Malcolm Brogdon had 16 points coming off the bench. Joe Mazzulla tightened that rotation, only played 7 guys in game 6, and I thought that was impactful. And yeah, Grant Williams, I don't think it was his fault necessarily, but keeping Rob Williams in that starting lineup and keeping the rotation tight, that worked for them. Not playing Sam Hauser, that worked for them. So I think everybody within the Celtics should get credit for keeping them in it until Jason Tatum caught fire and took over at the end. So now we head into a game 7, Herring, and I don't know what to predict here. I don't know what to expect in this game 7. The Celtics are going home, but they've lost their last 2 games in the Garden. They lost game 5 in biblically bad fashion in the Garden to the Sixers. You go back to the Atlanta series, they lost game 5 to the Hawks in the Garden. This is not a shoe-in if they go home, you know, going home. And this, all the pressure that was on Boston in that game 7, it's still there, but there's even more pressure on Philadelphia. Joel Embiid's going to go into that game 7 while Nikola Jokic is kicking back on his couch in Denver, reminding everyone this is his second conference finals that he's gone to. All those people that said Nikola Jokic would not be you know, the same guy in the playoffs wouldn't be as reliable as Joel Embiid. Well, Jokic sitting there waiting for that other side of the bracket to finish, and Joel Embiid is fighting for his playoff life. So there's a lot of pressure there. James Harden, if they get beat in the second round and they lose two straight to finish, I already think it's lunacy to give James Harden a $200-plus million contract. I think that's nuts. But I think it would effectively ensure that Philadelphia wouldn't go in that direction, because why would you? You have not advanced further than you advanced before James Harden got there. So there's pressure on him. There's pressure on Doc Rivers, who could be coaching for his job, you know, in this game. So I think the pressure has now shifted squarely to Philadelphia. Harry, what do you think?
It has. I mean, I don't think that's to say that, as you kind of laid out, that Boston doesn't have any. I mean, Tatum, the early stages of these games, like, I don't know what it is. Because, I mean, he's still getting good enough looks. Some of the shots are just rimming out. But other times, he just looks like, I don't know why I keep referencing Space Jam so much, but he looks like the Monstar sapped his talent, like, in the first half of these games. And I mean, that's not to take away from the playmaking. I know he had, was it 6 assists at half or whatever it was, or, you know, early in the third quarter. He's still making plays. He's still there defensively. Boston was fantastic defensively and deserves a lot of credit for that early in the game. I thought that they were just taking away everything at the rim, which is obviously part of having the two bigs out there. But, you know, I don't think this necessarily solves all their problems just because they won this game. I know that's not what you're hinting at, Chris. But, you know, it until something else shifts, I don't think they're demonstrably better. Maybe they get to breathe a little bit more comfortably, but they've struggled enough here in these last few games to where I don't think anything is a given for them just because they managed to do this. I will say that from Tatum's standpoint, if they do come out and win this series, get to the finals, maybe win the whole thing, the way that this game 6 is going to be looked at and Tatum's performance coming through there is going to be talked about as like a Kobe sort of moment. Of a Michael Jordan sort of. I mean, we also saw the stats that suggested that there have only been a handful of people ever in this situation, or at least in the last 20, 30 years, whatever it's been, who've performed that poorly as a volume shooter and then come through and just kind of torn the roof off the place. So I could very much see it being that sort of thing. There's pressure both ways. I do think there's more riding on it for Philly, even just from the standpoint of Joe Mazzulla. He's not going anywhere after this season. You know, if Boston for some reason doesn't come through and win this, we can't say that about Doc for sure. And the Harden thing, I mean, it's tough. I'm sure he's probably like, damn, didn't I just have 45 and 42? But even if they do win this series and falter in the next series or anything, giving Harden the max of what he could earn just seems like a no-go here for me, just because it's too on and off. It's not consistent. He's not the same guy consistently anymore, which you would also expect, given where he's at age-wise, the load that he's carried. But there's just more riding on it for Philly, certainly, but Boston's not without pressure here by any means.
Yeah, it's not that the Celtics don't have pressure. It's just if they lose, they're going to get cooked for it. I mean, Tatum will get cooked for it. Brown will get cooked for it. Mazzulla will get cooked for it. But I don't think there'd be any kind of tangible ripple effect. I mean, Jaylen Brown just got all NBA. That, to me, pretty well signals that he's going to sign a max-level extension with Boston this summer. Jason Tatum's not
curious.
Going anywhere.
I'm still curious about that.
Guys take the money.
The Celtics will pay him. It's more a question of I don't think and me and Ron have had this conversation. I think it was an episode where you weren't with us. Like, we don't think he's leaving, but at the same time, he strikes me as enough of a wild card and enough of a guy that on principle might just say, like, man, I'm going to make a lot of money wherever I go. I think you would have to be unhappy, but there was more unhappiness under the surface than what I realized before those comments came out, not once, but basically twice in like a week long span.
Oh, I don't think signing the extension, you know, makes Brown a Celtic for life. I just think he's going to take the money. I mean, the number of people in his orbit that were lobbying for Jaylen Brown to be all NBA this year, you know,
I heard some of it too.
Like, you know,
that's
a good point. Yeah. I mean, it's great to be all NBA. It's a nice accolade, a feather in their cap, but it's the tangible effect of it. The fact that you can now get a supermax contract that's worth $295 million on the long end of that deal. I think the Celtics will offer it. I think Tatum will sign it, and then we'll see. You know, Tatum, as we've
seen a good point.
From lots of players in recent years, he could just ask out, and the Celtics may be forced to trade him down the line. Yeah. The Sixers, they could be reinvented after this year. Joel Embiid's not going anywhere, but he could have a new coach. He could have a new wingman. The only surefire guys that'll be around next year are Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey, I think. So this is everything for Philadelphia. Like, this is their season. This is their future. There's a lot on the line for the 76ers in this Game 7 on Sunday. All right. I want to talk about what we saw in that Phoenix.
Mannix, actually, real quick. Do you mind if I got a question for you, a serious one, before we move on to that next series. So I tweeted last night before the fourth quarter, because you could already see the Tatum discourse on Twitter spiraling a bit, which is never really a good place to get your discourse in general. But, you know, I said something to the effect of, this guy's only 25. He had 46 on the road in Milwaukee last year. He took the team to the finals as a 24-year-old as their best player. You know, he's had big game sevens on the road. I think his resume is pretty good. Yes, he struggled in the finals. A lot of players struggle in their first finals. A lot of greats have struggled in the finals before. You know, and here I am defending Jason Tatum, and I got a lot of Celtics fans tweeting at me, how much longer are we going to give him a pass? He keeps showing up small. I was kind of shocked that there was any of this sentiment out there. I'm curious if you've picked that up, or do you know where that kind of, like, seems to be a weird, like, a little bit of a Tatum backlash brewing, and I wonder if you sense a similar thing.
Yeah, but it's Boston. There's a backlash if you don't succeed at the highest level every single year. Like, you know, all that backlash quickly, you know, did a 180 after Tatum went off in the last 4.5 minutes of the fourth quarter. I think there is some anxiety about this season because, look, the runway is clear. The Bucks are no longer in it. The Western Conference, even though Denver is really good, you know, Denver's certainly not unbeatable. Like, this looks like and feels like the year this Celtics team can win a championship. You can't always say that about previous years. When they went to the conference finals, you know, those years before, and ran to LeBron James, you know, you're not going to beat LeBron, even if you take him to 7 games in one of those series. Last year, even though they had a 2-1 series lead, you're still going up against Golden State, and that team was just better than the Celtics were at this time. I don't think there's a team out there, including Denver, that's better than Boston right now. I think they're the best team that's left behind, and if they go out because Jason Tatum, the de facto superstar, the top 5 MVP, the all-NBA first team guy, because he plays terrible, he would have become, you know, public enemy number one for a while in Boston, that's for sure. All right, let's talk about the Suns and the Nuggets. And let's start with the good, Rohan. Let's start with Denver. Are the Nuggets better than we thought they were coming into the playoffs? I just mentioned how, you know, Jokic was, you know, part of the reason he didn't win MVP is probably because there were a lot of people out there that thought that he was going to flame out in the playoffs. That if it wasn't the first round against Minnesota, he was definitely going out in the second round against the Clippers or the Suns. Turns out, not so much. Jokic puts up monster numbers in this series, kicks the crap out of everybody in Phoenix. DeAndre Ayton basically waved the white flag at the end of that series. That's how miserable he was.
Wow.
Come on.
I'm not going there.
Let's
be
real.
I'm not going there.
Let's be real.
Do you think DeAndre Ayton was... Do you think DeAndre Ayton deep down was happy last night? Part of me thinks he was a little happy.
I don't know, man. Hey, look, you know, far be it for me to criticize a guy with an injury, as I'm about to criticize a guy with an injury. But come on.
Like, you already have.
It kind of felt like he threw in the towel.
I'm just saying, like, A rib injury feels like playing, like something you can play through, right? If you really have to, you can play through some kind of pain. We got guys this playoff.
Wiggins has some sort of rib thing too, so it's like it is interesting. I didn't realize. It's also tough not being at the games.
Wiggins isn't
going
to play. You think Wiggins isn't going to play?
That's what I'm saying. It starts to look a whole lot. It's a tough scene, and I mean, the only reason I hesitate to do that. I haven't spoken to the guy really before that I know of. I've been in their locker room before. I don't think I've ever talked with him specifically. So I just hesitate to do it without knowing him. But look, we've seen that there've been, you know, there's been turbulence in that locker room before. We know, I mean, the last time we talked about this sort of turbulence with Phoenix was when they got rocked in a deciding game last season, you know, at home, no less.
And he was on the bench for that one, too.
Where, you know, Monty had plenty to say by basically saying nothing about DeAndre Ayton. So I get that part. I can't remember someone having kind of their perception colored more by one moment, particularly like a top pick, than I can with that. And in recent memory, I'm sure if I really thought about it, maybe I could, but it's really interesting, like how little he seems to say out loud, but how much has been colored by that moment. So I'm not going to say it's fair or it's not. I won't quite go that far, but I remember thinking, wow, for all the stuff that everybody else is playing through, AD in his situation, where, let's be honest, if we're going to talk about our takes here, the guy looked like he was concussed. And it seemed very clear that, like, maybe the Lakers didn't want to test him for a concussion because they didn't want to get back bad news and then have to put him in protocol. The fact that they said
wheelchaired off the floor,
like, wheelchaired, woozy. We saw him. The fact that there were, I think Dave McMiniman from ESPN took video of him leaving the arena, and the person walking with AD asked the person to turn off the lights that were in front of him because of that. Like it kind of telltale things that look like the guy is concussed. And then the there was never an official statement from the Lakers. The one that I remember seeing, I think from Chris Haynes, saying that he appeared to have avoided a concussion. I'm like, did you test him for one? And I'm not convinced that I'm not convinced at all that they did. But even him,
where's the NBA? Where's the NBA on this one?
Yeah,
like where is the Look, I don't want to see Anthony Davis sit out Game Six. I mean, this
neither do
this
I.
This is a massive game. But I agree. I agree with you. Yeah, you have to go through the process. Otherwise, your process is utterly meaningless. It doesn't matter if, like, campaign, you know, is concussed in game 62 of the regular season.
Yes.
That's not where your concussion protocols get really tested. It's right now in this situation when, again, none of us on this pod are doctors, but you just have to see the reaction of Anthony Davis, how he looked on the bench, how he had to be wheelchaired out, how much time he spent in the locker room, and how he was walking, as Chris said, with his guy in front of him saying, turn off the light. These are all pretty telltale signs of a concussion. And look, the Lakers know if he goes in concussion protocols, he ain't playing Game 6. There's just not enough time.
Probably not Game 7 either, to be honest. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's tough from that standpoint. I got us away from the conversation you were raising, which was about.
Yes, because I got a lot of Nuggets takes loaded up.
Well, fire away, Rohan, because I do think that, you know, we, and I use the kind of the royal we here, and generally, media, fans, everybody, probably didn't give the Nuggets the credit they deserve coming into the playoffs.
Well, if I may quote a famous Miami poet, Rick Ross, no sir, not me, because we did in late 2022, we did in late 2022 we were asked for 2023 predictions, and I predicted the Nuggets would win the finals. They were my finals pick before the season. And they have been so good. I literally wrote for today for SportsIllustrated.com, are you taking the Nuggets seriously yet? Nikola Jokic in the second round, you know, the belt's been passed around a little bit. I think Jimmy Butler had it. I think Devin Booker had it. There's nobody in the universe playing basketball better right now than Nikola Jokic. 35 points, 13 rebounds, and 10 assists on 59% shooting in the second round. In the playoffs, he's at 31-13 and 9.7. He's three assists away from averaging a triple-double for the entire playoffs. He has been unreal. Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic are not discussed enough as one of the best duos in the NBA. The last time they were healthy for the playoffs, they knocked out Kawhi and PG the only time they were healthy for the postseason. This year, they knock out Kevin Durant and Devin Booker. I know the Suns were undermanned, but this is exactly the kind of team everyone thought would expose Denver defensively. What if I told you in the postseason the Denver Nuggets have a better defensive rating than the Philadelphia 76ers? They've been really good defensively on balance for the postseason. They've been better defensively. Hold on, I have the list here. Than the Lakers, the Knicks, the 76ers. Like, they've been really good. They've been legit defensively. They're not necessarily locking people down. But everyone, you know, comes in, oh, teams are going to run 75 pick and rolls. I think that's what Jamal Crawford said. They're going to put the MVP in pick and roll every night. Guess what? Anthony Davis is putting the pick and roll every night. Joel Embiid is putting the pick and roll every night. Jokic has, I think, stood up to the task. He's been fantastic. This team is really good. To say they're a legitimate contender, I think, is an understatement. I would have them as the title favorite right now. I agree, Boston, on paper, you'd think should be better. What they did in the regular season, top two in offense and defense, has the profile of a title contender. But no one is playing better than the Nuggets. No one's playing more connected than the Nuggets. They have a deep team. The guys they brought in the offseason, Bruce Brown, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, have filled their roles to a T. To me, this team's been fantastic. And I get it, the last month of the season, it was kind of like, what are they doing here? Why is this team taking its foot off the gas? That seems more intentional now than anything else, because the way they've ramped up in the postseason has been fantastic. And I'll just end on this note, because Jokic obviously didn't win his third MVP. I think people have been skeptical about his first two. They're sick of the idea that he was going to win a third. They think he's just this advanced stats guy. You look at the MVP finalists, Jokic, Giannis, Embiid. Jokic has been far and away the best player. It's not close. Embiid, his points are down, his rebounds are down, his assists are down, his field goal percentage is down, his turnovers are up. It's the opposite for Jokic. He's just been incredible. And I think at this point, I think it would be an upset if this team didn't at least make the finals.
Herring, anything to add to that?
No, I mean, first of all, can we just say, first of all, I was surprised that Jokic didn't get more votes. I went with Embiid for MVP, but I thought it would be closer than it was. I don't think
it might have been if Mark Jackson had given Jokic.
Man, I've never seen somebody call into the radio station sooter than he did. Like,
by the way,
and 10 minutes later,
I got
saw his name.
That was my slot on NBA radio. I was in a car going to the TV studio. I got a call saying Mark Jackson's calling in. I got bumped.
Hey, man. He made a beeline to that, you know, to that phone conversation.
Can I real quick, Chris? Do you guys think you really made a mistake? Do we really think he made a mistake?
It
sounds to me like he got confused with what he was voting for exactly.
We should say what he did. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me kind of set it up, right? So only one voter, and we knew this a couple of weeks ago when the MVP, or a week or so ago, I guess this point, when the MVP award voting came out. But we knew that one voter did not put Nikola Jokic in the top five. We did not know until Thursday who that voter was. But the NBA reveals all the ballots. They're transparent with this process. And it was revealed that Mark Jackson, the former head coach, ESPN NBA analyst, he was the one that did not vote for Nikola Jokic. Now, Mark Jackson, as Herring said, quickly came out and said, no, it was a mistake. It was a mistake. I didn't mean to do it. Herring, I got a hard time kind of buying that because, look, number one, you have opportunities to kind of fact check yourself before you submit your ballot, right? So for people to understand this, there are scroll down tiles where you pick the top five or top three, whatever it is that you're putting for MVP. At the end of the ballot, before you submit it, it kind of shows you who you voted for. And then you get an email with who you voted for. So you get multiple opportunities to double check who was on your ballot. And by the way, on top of that, the NBA also has kind of a fail-safe here. Mark Broussard with the NBA, like, for example, there's two Jalen Williams in Oklahoma City, two rookies. Mark Broussard with the NBA was on standby for a while to make sure that if the right guy got voted for, if they didn't, you know, he was going to call you to double check what happened. If you voted for the exact right guy. So, I don't know, man. I think that to me, Herring, is a pretty
glaring
mistake to make.
And
I do believe
what his argument was of how he mistakenly did it. I think he was claiming...
So, because he says, you can tell I put one center, two forwards, and two guards, is what he said in his quote.
So
maybe
he thought it was like an all-NBA
team
with the way that he voted for it. But I still, like, okay.
Or maybe he's like, it's not important who goes after number one. You know what I mean?
Oh, no. I had a tough, like, a lot of people were just saying, and I kind of agreed with this, but, like, also, I don't know him well enough. He's probably, maybe he's telling the truth, but for me, I'm like, oh, that seems like a difficult way. First of all, we had an all-NBA team, the first team that you could have voted for, that you did vote for. If you had a vote, you were voting for that, too. So what, you were going to vote for that NBA team twice? It's whatever. Like, I would have had... I would have felt more strongly about this if it was a situation where Jokic was unanimous and that this is the one guy that doesn't vote for him at all. Jokic didn't win, and it fundamentally wasn't like the vote made the difference between Jokic winning or not. But my whole only point was to say, you could have gone either way. I think you could have gone any one of three ways to vote for this, and I'm not going to side-eye you that hard. Frankly, I think maybe I don't want to use the word guilty because I don't think I did anything wrong. The end of the Nuggets season disappointed me. And I thought, to be honest with you, the way that Michael Malone was talking about it, he seemed disappointed in it, which I'm sure coaches always want their teams to play well. They weren't tanking or anything like that. But he basically said more than once, if we don't shape up really soon, we're going to get beat in the first round, let alone second, third, whatever. We're not going to make it if we keep playing like this. That included really ugly games. Did they lose to the Rockets? They almost lost to the Spurs. They had a stretch where they lost 5 out of 6 or 6 out of 7. And part of what bothered me with it was that Jokic would have Jokic-type games where he's, you know, 9 of 12, 9 of 13, whatever, shooting well, producing numbers. But when they're in the clutch and in trouble, he's not the one taking shots, which maybe there's postseason benefit to that, to let other guys work through their stuff, to let other guys feel like they get to take a big shot too, Jamal Murray and everybody else. There were moments where I wanted to see him take a little bit more on his shoulders from a scoring standpoint. We know he's efficient, and we know he's capable of scoring when the going gets tough. But there were so many times where I'm like, I wish he would do a little bit more from a scoring standpoint, because he makes the right play so often.
The last 6 weeks.
And it did feel that way. And so I've been wrong about that before from the standpoint of, what does this mean for this team as a contender? I can't remember exactly what year it was. Was it 2018 or 2019? One of the years where the Sixers were way too young, theoretically, to make a real serious run at the finals. But I remember when I was at 538, our model had them as being like one of the favorites, because our model at the time was kind of had a bias toward like, how have you been playing lately, that was built into the model. And the Sixers had won like 12 or 13 in a row with a week to go left in the season. And it had them with a greater probability of winning the title than maybe even Golden State at the time, which obviously was wrong. And so maybe I have it built in the same way that we've watched the Cavs do that with LeBron, where they just don't care. They don't play any defense, and then they make it back to the finals like they always do. So it's hard to pick up on that, particularly when it's the first time that this team has done that and they've been healthy. And I think everybody was waiting to kind of crown them as the team. They would have probably had that. And when they didn't actually coalesce and look like they were on the same page until the very end of all of it, I defaulted and said, okay, if no one's going to really stand up and declare themselves, I'll take Phoenix. Maybe the cohesion doesn't matter as much as I thought. This series proved that that was absolutely wrong. And they look ready. I think it would be a fascinating series. It'll be fascinating either way. But if they get a rematch now with Golden State at full strength, you know, the team that everybody kind of felt like showed how fraudulent Denver was last year. Okay, you can't be fraudulent when you don't have
Austin Rivers was getting – he was guarding Steph Curry.
But I think it was one of those things where it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you didn't think Jokic deserved MVP or what have you, you were going to use how fraudulent Denver looked as a rationale. Even though Jokic was playing his butt off, even though Draymond gave Jokic total props for how much of a superstar the guy is. So this just validates the fact that Denver was always real when they had these two. Whether you thought they were the favorite or not, you now see that they should at least be considered one of them, if not the favorite. They looked fantastic in this series. Even if they didn't sweep or gentlemen sweep the series, they were fantastic. Even if Paul was out, they were fantastic.
I don't know if you guys watched Game of Thrones, but there's a scene in one of the middle seasons.
Yeah, we watched Game of Thrones, dude. Come on.
I didn't watch it. Assume. You're right, don't assume.
Excuse me.
I watch a lot of TV, but I'm not a big Game of Thrones person. Go ahead.
Oh, my God.
So there's a scene in one of the middle seasons where one of the men of the Night's Watch stands up and says he will not serve Jon Snow. and he looks around, and I think he felt he was going to have the protection of the mob there where a bunch of people would stand up. That's how I feel about Mark Jackson. I feel like Mark Jackson, there's a possibility that Mark Jackson thought there would be more than one person that left Nikola Jokic off the MVP ballot and went that way. It could be wrong, just a theory. You know, more likely than not, Mark's telling the truth. He did have two forwards, a center, two guards. Mistakes do happen. There are some gaffes on these ballots, but, you know, I couldn't help but think
there's no reason
maybe,
to lie about it. I mean,
yes, there is. Of course there is, because you're on your own. You have to explain why you left Nikola Jokic, by the way, just kicked the crap out of Phoenix, yet why you left him off your ballot.
I mean, but what's going to fundamentally happen to him if he just owns it? I feel like he probably did vote that way, thinking that that was how it worked, or I don't know why. But my thought is like, is ESPN going to take him out of his? I don't think that's going to happen.
No, and if it's no, they're not going to take him out of
fundamentally,
it. Fundamentally,
you could just
own.
Be viewed as a hater at that point, and I think that's fine too. Like, I mean,
look, Mark. But look, yeah, this is the equivalent. This is the equivalent of I got hacked, right? Like the only excuse, like oh, I got hacked.
It did sound that way a little bit.
Am I the only one who thought his apology sounded like good?
Like, I was fine. It was well thought out. Look, yeah. Look, more likely than not,
quick.
That's exactly what happened. More
and it was
likely
quick.
Not, that's what happened. But I will allow for the possibility that maybe Mark Jackson thought a few other people would leave Nikola Jokic off the ballot.
Yo, DeAndre Ayton is listening to this right now saying like, damn, Mark Jackson gets the benefit of the doubt, but I don't.
Not right now. No. Not after a year's worth of stuff with DeAndre Ayton that began right around this time last year. All right, last thing I want to talk about, the future of the Phoenix Suns. It was about 2 months ago that I sat down in Matt Ishbia's office in Phoenix, and we talked about the risks of putting this type of team together. And Matt Ishbia looked me in the eye and said, there are no risks with making this Durant deal and putting this type of team together. Well, you just saw what the risks are. You have a 38-year-old point guard who has a history of groin pulls and quad strains and things like that that have kept him out of key moments in the postseason. That happened again. You have a player in DeAndre Ayton. Let's go with what they say, being hurt. DeAndre was hurt during the year as well, so him being out of the lineup shouldn't be all that surprising. So now you enter the offseason where all of a sudden, we're talking about, is Monty Williams the right coach for this team? We're talking about, is Chris Paul going to be the point guard next year, or are they going to try to offload him and his partially guaranteed contract in favor of somebody else? The best player on your team is going to be, what, 35 next year and has an injury history of his own? This was the risk, Rohan. This was the risk the Suns took when they put this team together. I never believed they were going to win this year, because you just don't make a trade that seismic and have it all kind of come together in the first postseason of your team being together. Not to mention the fact that they didn't even play games together, play like three or four games as a unit during the regular season. I thought they needed a transaction cycle. I thought they needed a full training camp, but they may need more. Like, Chris Paul may no longer be the guy. You can't say they lost to Denver because Chris Paul was out. The two games they won, didn't play in. So, they may need some kind of significant upgrade. And the problem is, they don't have the assets to go get it anymore. They traded all them. Brooklyn's got all them. So, I think the Suns are in kind of a perilous situation where it's going to take some craftiness for them to get the right pieces for them to make a title run next season.
So, first of all, it pains me to say I got to commend Chris Mannix. After the trade deadline, I came on this podcast and declared the Suns a favorite in the West. I thought they'd have a great chance to make the finals. Mannix said no, rode with the Lakers.
Yeah, Lakers.
Somehow.
Lakers. My picks rule.
Dog, I'm not even prepared for how much we're going to hear if the Lakers come out of the West, man. I'm not even prepared.
So, let me just get to Phoenix real quick, because Mannix is right. This is a massive test for James Jones, who's had kind of an up and down tenure here in Phoenix. I think he's made some brilliant decisions, and they've had some high profile misses as well. This is the biggest summer of his career as an executive. To Chris's point, Chris Paul is guaranteed for basically half his contract. He's owed $30.8 million next year, only 15.8 of which are guaranteed, which means he can be dumped. He can be dumped to a team that's either going to have cap room. Once again, look for Oklahoma City or someone like that to get involved, because he can be traded for and waived, and that team will only take a $15 million hit. Now, again, the Suns don't have a lot of assets to kind of attach to Chris Paul there, so it's not going to be simple to move him, but he's going to be movable. I've had people reach out to me, so they think this is Chris Paul's last run with this group. It's no secret they were trying to move him at the trade deadline. I'm not feeling great about his chances staying with this team moving forward. I think Monty Williams is another person, you know, who could be on the proverbial chopping block here after another disappointing second-round exit. And then there's DeAndre Ayton. I will be completely floored if DeAndre Ayton's on this team to start next season. He's someone who I think they desperately need to move for two rotation pieces. You're not going to get great players in return for DeAndre Ayton.
No, you're
not. With the cap going up. I will say, with the cap going up and him being a former number one overall pick, I think there are teams that are going to be willing to take a chance on him, whether that's Dallas, Detroit, Portland. I think there are landing spots for him. At this point, the Suns, they don't need to hit a home run. They need to hit a couple singles, a double. They just need rotation bodies.
Do you think the market for a disgruntled center who doesn't shoot threes is robust right now?
Look,
Him for Rudy Gobert, you could probably do that.
I think that Ayton, listen, if Russell Westbrook could get moved after his Lakers tenure for like three rotation players, Ayton is still going to be 25 this summer. He was a plus in the 2021 finals. They were better with him on the floor. You know, and he did a serviceable job against Giannis. In the past, he's had more success against Jokic. You could easily see an NBA team talking themselves into, he'll get along with our coach. He won't have to bump heads with Chris Paul. You know, we'll create a better environment for him. I'm not saying he's going to get a great return back, but I could definitely see an NBA team talking themselves.
Minnesota. Yeah,
into
that's,
DeAndre.
That's a tough scene, like, though, because it's like you're talking about a better environment for him than Monty Williams, Chris Paul, Devin Booker.
Okay.
I mean, like, there aren't that many
better. Did it look like he was...
But I agree
look like
with
he
you.
Was getting just, along with Monty Williams?
No. I'm not saying that he did, but I'm just saying, like, who doesn't, though? Like, how many guys don't? And I think that was why we talked about this so long. It's like, no, he wasn't ever going to win the Monty Williams thing. Monty Williams was coming off of a Coach of the Year award, a finals trip for a team that hadn't made the playoffs the year before. So I mean, someone will take a chance. I'm curious to see what they'll yield to get him.
Minnesota.
We'll get another opportunity. Man, Chris is on this hard.
I've already talked myself into some version of Chris Paul and DeAndre Ayton for Mike Conley and Rudy Gobert. Like, I've already talked myself into that.
I could see Chris Paul ending up in Chicago just because the Lonzo Ball thing is not clarifying at any point. Okay. Like, they need a point guard.
Chicago doesn't care. Yeah, they'll take anything to stay reasonably competitive.
And a name. Like, I think they've always liked when they can get somebody with a name.
What are they saying?
Dating back to the Dwayne Wade, the Jabari Parker stuff. Like, they've always been interested when they can get somebody that has some game left to them.
I don't think they could get him as a free agent. I think they could get him as a free agent.
The Suns just waive him?
I think that the team that trades for Chris Paul will waive him, is my guess, because they can. It's a $15 million savings.
Yeah. I mean,
Bulls are always interested in that part too, by the way.
Yeah, saving some money. Well, I do think that this was the year we saw a real decline. Like, we thought we saw it, you know, in years past, in Houston most notably. Chris Paul did a phenomenal job of working on his body, getting his game right. Tremendous in Oklahoma City. Tremendous his first few years in Phoenix. But this past year, whether it was the three-point shot or the defense or the inability to stay healthy, I think we've seen some decline. I don't know, though, Rohan, that you can just give him away. Like, I don't know that you can trade him for anything less than someone that's going to replace him, because campaign ain't it. Like, he's not the guy you plug in there to play next to Devin Booker and Kevin Durant and that collection. I don't know. I don't know. It's going to be complicated. I've seen the Lakers float as a possibility. They always will be, but I don't know what they would send back. Like, do you do a sign and trade involving?
Do you do a sign and trade with Russell?
I don't know.
I could see it. I mean,
Lakers would be crazy. The Lakers are. If the Lakers win this series against the Warriors and they even touch that roster, they should all be cooked publicly for that, because they've got something that works. You don't need to bring in 38-year-old Chris Paul when you have 27, 8-year-old D'Angelo Russell already there.
It would be a repeat of the mistakes they've made too, which is have a good roster then trade for someone who doesn't make sense. I just think that Phoenix needs, they just need like the KCPs of the world who, I mean, every team wants them. They're easier, you know, to get, or easier to say to get them than to do it, but they don't need to go star hunting, right? They just, I think what this series showed is they just need capable rotation bodies. When you look at a guy like Bruce Brown, who I think
Bruce
his price
Brown
is
killed them rightfully, in the series.
Right, Bruce Brown's price has rightfully gone way up.
Boston's own.
He was available last year. Miami Hurricanes' own Bruce Brown. You know, those guys are out there. But like I said, it's going to be on James Jones. He has to identify the right talent. But they don't need to get a star. They don't need to get someone at Ayton's salary, at Chris Paul's salary. They need to turn those contracts into two guys who aren't going to kill you in a playoff series, aren't going to be as boom or bust as a Landry Shamet. But, you know, even if they had like a Javon Carter type who they used to have on the team, ironically, like those are the players they need to put around Booker and Durant. And I think they'll be in a better position moving forward.
Yeah, I just think it's going to be a challenge. You know, at some point, mm-hmm. Durant is going to stop being Durant. I've seen some arguments that were already kind of there, that he's, you know, not the superstar he was as recently as his last full year in Brooklyn. So, you know, this again, this was the risk Matt Ishbia took. He went all in. He put all his draft picks. He traded Mikal Bridges. He went out and got this superstar-laden team. And now, you know, you can envision a scenario where they're once again battling for that 4-5 seed next year. And that's not what this new ownership group is paying for with this this Phoenix Suns organization. So
can I throw out a little bit of a very early? I mean, what if you call Utah up? Do you think Utah's committed to Colin Sexton? They could get off that contract. Kelly Olynyk. These are the kinds of guys I think they should be looking after, yeah, like a Taylor Horton Tucker.
Like Colin Sexton's not the answer with that team. Like you want a guy that also needs the ball in his hands a lot to you know, he's kind of a volume guy. It's not a great place to be if you're Phoenix, having to make this decision.
They're tough. And with the new, I think, I wish I could credit the person. It might have been Kevin O'Connor. So I'll have to find out who did it. But they're going to also be creeping up against that second tax apron at some point in the near future. You know, they have a ton of money committed to very few guys next year. That's going to be another issue for them. Another reason why I'm nervous about the CBA, but that'll be fascinating for them to figure out.
It's tough, man. You have two of, I mean, where would you put Booker? No less than what, like the 11th, 12th best guy in the league. You've got two top 12 guys. You've got a sitter that I still think most teams in the league would like to have, even if he, you know, if we have questions about how committed he is or whatever else.
It didn't bother you, Herring, that the Nets didn't want him? Like, the Nets didn't want him. Like, they were not looking for DeAndre Ayton in that deal. Like, that, to me, is a red flag.
It is, and what's so interesting about it is that with, again, Rohan pointed out that he was more than serviceable. He was legitimately good in the finals. Granted, it was a couple of years ago. I understand it more when we're talking about, like, a Ben Simmons and whether you want to trade for him. I remember the first time the Harden conversation came up that essentially Houston didn't want Simmons back. That wasn't the – and I understood it because with Simmons – he's got so many, really one key deficiency, but it's a big enough one where it's like, okay, do you want to structure your team around someone that can't do this? I don't view Ayton as being that limited. Like you said, he's not really a guy that's shooting threes, but he's better defensively than he gets credit for. I don't think he took a real step forward this year, which is unlike the other years where you could have pointed to what he was doing. He has shown that he can produce even when Chris Paul isn't there, but he doesn't necessarily have enough to him where he's like, okay, Chris Paul's out and we're not getting enough scoring from other guys. I'm going to take it upon myself to go get you 40. Like, he's not that guy, and I think that's ultimately what you want when you're about to give up the farm. I don't know what the farm is anymore. The farm is like doubled in square footage over the last year when we're looking at teams give up 5 picks or whatever for Rudy Gobert. I don't know how many picks it would be, but I think in order for it to make sense from what we're talking about, you need Ayton to be able to go get you someone to replace Chris Paul and functionally replace Ayton's spot too, and maybe one more rotation guy. And it is interesting in light of saying, like, what's the market for him? You're right. If last year you couldn't convince Brooklyn to want him at a time where Brooklyn was trying to reshuffle their deck, or at least for a while they were, before they called off the KD thing, it is going to be really fascinating to see what you get for him. But really, the return on Ayton, and maybe to some extent with Chris Paul, if they don't waive him, if they trade him somewhere, that's the future of this team, because you've got an older Durant, and you've got Booker, and you traded Mikal Bridges. Obviously, he looks really great right now with Brooklyn. It's not to say they shouldn't have done it, but there were always risks involved with it. Some of these problems are going to, these chickens are going to come home to roost anyway with the Chris Paul situation. You kind of had until the end of his tenure with the Suns to theoretically figure it out before you've got to transition to something different. We don't know how that will look, what that will look like, who they're replacing him with, whether they keep Ayton. But they've got some real, real questions to answer. And it's part of the reason that it was really the same way we've talked about Philly maybe squandering a chance. Phoenix had the Bucks down 2-0 in that series a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And I thought about it more through that prism at the time, through Chris Paul's prism of just like, will he ever get this title? And now to some extent you're asking the same question of, will KD get another one? Can the Suns win one at all, despite the fact that they've got two top 10, top 12 guys? It's a really unique sort of question to be asking, question to be raising.
I got one more for y'all.
Fake trades with Rohan here right now. Fake
yeah,
trades.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Just one
big
more.
Big brain
just
Rohan.
More. Just one more here. Ayton and Chris Paul for Terry Rozier and Gordon Hayward.
No. If you're Phoenix.
Because you have too many of the injury problems with Gordon Hayward. Rozier, I'm fine with taking on, but Gordon
Hayward's
not healthy
enough.
But then
Hayward's an expiring that maybe you can flip into something else at the deadline, a la Westbrook.
I'll probably wait to see.
You guys are thinking about it. You guys are thinking about it.
I like Rozier. I think Rozier's underrated. I think he slots in well to a situation like that. I don't like the Hayward fit, though, personally. Mm-hmm. With a team that already has as many injury concerns as that team has.
You know, my problem with the Suns is that, not that they went out and got Kevin Durant, because you know I agree with the masses that say when you have an opportunity to get Kevin Durant, you go and do it. I just think that opportunity would have been there this summer. I think they met the Nets' asking price when they didn't have to. Like, Kevin Durant wasn't going to be long for Brooklyn one way or the other. And the Suns were always going to be in an advantageous position, in part because Kevin Durant wanted to be there, and in part because they did have a collection of assets, be it young players, draft picks, things they could do. I think that, you know, 3 years from now, when this story is kind of written, is what maybe we look back on. You know, could the Suns have just been a little more patient? Matt Ishbia was not looking to be patient. He was coming in looking to make a big splash. He pushed this deal over the finish line in large part because he said, we can deal Mikal Bridges. It's fine. Let's go get Kevin Durant. I think the great what if is going to be, what might have happened if they did this deal in June or July and were able to keep Bridges and have Bridges there alongside Durant, alongside Booker?
I mean, could they have really done it without Bridges?
They wouldn't do it before, but like, it was close before. They discussed a deal over the summer, and look, it was, well, not super close, obviously it didn't get done, but I think there would have been a framework for a deal to get done that did not include Mikal Bridges. That's just my read on it, that... And part of that would have included pressure. Wow. Brooklyn didn't feel any real pressure. At least they weren't showing it over the summer. They basically said, look, we're going to get the deal we want, or else, Kevin, you're going to stick it out, and we're going to see what Kevin, Kyrie, and this group can actually do. Well, Kyrie was gone before the Kevin Durant trade happened. And, you know, there would have been a lot more pressure on Brooklyn this coming summer to do a deal, because Kevin Durant would have said, I'm out. I'm really out this time. Like, it's not going to work with this team. So, I just think that's the great what if. You know, if they'd be able to keep Bridges, that's a game changer for this team. All right. Subscribe, rate, review this podcast on Apple Podcasts, wherever you download podcasts, and we will see you next week.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.